Welcome to the latest Reaction podcast. I'm Maggie Pagano, and with me to talk about that vexed subject, Britain in Europe, is Professor Vernon Bogdanor. Professor Bogdanor is one of Britain's most distinguished constitutional and political experts and Professor of Politics at King's College. He's just written a very timely book based on some lectures he gave to Yale University last year called Britain and Europe in a Troubled World. And for anybody who wants to know why it is we've left and we're having these struggles today with Brexit, this book is a fabulous read. So what is your prognosis from the readout that we were given last night? Another deadline? Well, it's not quite a deadline, is it? More talks until Sunday.
I think if one counted up the deadlines, you'd reach a very large number. Yeah. Never a deadline, really, till 1st of January, I suppose. And even then, I suppose talks could continue. But you're really asking me to make a prediction about the future. And the great film producer, Sam Goldwyn, said, I never make predictions, especially about the future. But my hunch, and it may be proved wrong, my guess would be there will be a deal. But what I would say is that's less important than the fact that in January the 1st, we're going to be outside the internal market and the customs union of the European Union, whether we get a deal or not. That is what is crucial. The tariffs of the EU, they're high in one or two areas, but they're not, in general, on average, horrendously high. So we could manage without a deal. But it's going to be very difficult for us being outside the internal market and the customs union. And so far, Brexit has had hardly any effect in Britain because it's been Brexit in name only. But from January the 1st, it really kicks in. And the worry, of course, is the extra paperwork by being outside the EU regulatory area. If you compare the time it takes to get a lorry through from Britain to the continent now, it's about, on average, say 5 hours. And it's broadly as easy to send goods from London today to Paris or Berlin or Copenhagen as it is to Birmingham or Manchester or Glasgow or Swansea or Belfast. That won't be the case after January the 1st. Now, if you look at a country which is outside the customs union and outside the internal market, like Belarus, it takes on average 5 days for lorries to get through. Now, the difference between 5 hours and 5 days is pretty heavy. If you look at Turkey, which is in the EU customs union, but outside the internal market, there are huge delays in lorries. 2 days is considered reasonable. So I'm very worried that companies may not be able to cope with the extra costs. Many of them work on small margins. And with COVID, there are going to be very, very great difficulties.
I think they're already at the ports in Britain and Felixstowe already queuing. I mean, that's partly because of COVID, but I guess the anticipation of business. Vernon, you've often said that Margaret Thatcher misunderstood the internal market. Can you explain that to us? I think it sounds...
Margaret Thatcher was one of the architects of the EU internal market. And perhaps it's one of the paradoxes of Brexit that the two initiatives, two great British initiatives, two great Margaret Thatcher initiatives, which were the internal market and extension of the European Union to the Central and Eastern European ex-communist countries, they're the two factors which led in a way to Brexit, because the admission of the ex-communist countries led to a huge increase in immigration, which was a very salient issue in the referendum. And the internal market led to much greater integration on the part of the EU, which I think was inevitable. And with the internal market, which came about as a result of the Single European Act in 1986, that's the most important of the amendments to the EU constitution. With that came the removal of the veto and the extension of majority voting. Now, Margaret Thatcher was not against that. She was in favour because she said, perfectly rightly, that if you have over 300 non-tariff barriers to remove and each country has a veto, you'll never do it. So you have to do that by majority vote. But she didn't want it extended further. She wanted it used just for internal market matters because she saw the internal market as simply a free trade agreement, a kind of extension of World Trade Organization matters, a liberalization, a marketization, if you like, of the European Union. They saw it differently. They saw it as an internal market which required regulation, and in their view, it required certain social and environmental standards to be common amongst the countries, certain standards perhaps in the labour market amongst the countries, just as you have, for example, within Britain and within the United States, broadly speaking, common social, environmental and labour standards. And that Margaret Thatcher did not fully comprehend. And to the extent that she did, she was opposed to it because she said this will limit British sovereignty, the ability to make decisions for ourselves. So we've got this conflict, if you like, between national self-determination and sovereignty and multilateralism. And that's a conflict, as it were, within liberalism itself, if you like. And Margaret Thatcher took one side, and then at the time, people like Geoffrey Howe, Michael Heseltine, took the other side. There's a conflict within the Conservative Party, which in some ways is still there, it's certainly there in the Labour Party. And it's dogged and bedeviled our membership of the European Union until finally we've decided to leave.
If she had understood it as well as you've explained before, would she have gone ahead and still joined it, do you think? And maybe that is the broader misapprehension that we have in Britain towards the EU. It is a protectionist bloc.
That's a very good point. You see, in retirement, she took that point of view. She said it was a historic mistake for us to join. She wrote a book called Statecraft, in which she said we should try and secure fundamental reform in Europe. And if, as I think unlikely, if that didn't work, we should leave. Because you're absolutely right that we never really shared the point of view of the Europeans, because their aim in creating it was not primarily economic, and certainly not primarily federal. It was a peace initiative, a peace project. And that peace project required the sacrifice of sovereignty by countries which shared, in the words of Robert Schuman, French foreign minister in the late 1940s, a common European destiny. Now, you don't mind sharing power with someone with whom you think you have a common destiny. For example, a married couple doesn't mind sharing a bank account because they think they have a common destiny. We don't mind sharing our budget with people in Lancashire or Yorkshire because we have a common destiny. There are some arguments now about Scotland. Do we have a common destiny with them? The SNP would say, no, we don't. Now, this is a question about Europe. Do we feel a common destiny? Now, the argument was people in France, Germany, Italy, and that did feel that common destiny. We didn't. We joined for utilitarian economic motives. And therefore, when the economy started going wrong, we said, well, perhaps we don't want to stay in this relationship. It wasn't, as it were, a marriage, or if it was a marriage, it was a marriage of convenience, which we sought to end when it was no longer convenient. Mm. I think there was only one prime minister who shared that view about a common destiny, and that was Edward Heath. Yeah. But whether he was really ever in tune with the British people is a very big question.
And you make the point that apart from Boris Johnson, actually every prime minister that we've had since we joined has been in favour. But isn't one of the flaws that they may for 40 years have been in favour, but nobody has actually done a very good job of explaining or articulating that philosophy of a common destiny? We've always had this tension. And maybe it goes back 2,000 years since the Romans came. I don't know. But, you know, there's a sort of accident of geography, isn't there? Which I think is part of that problem, that we do not have a shared destiny.
Well, while you've been talking, I've been thinking, you're talking, of course, about my recent book.
Yes, I know. Which
makes this point. And it's absolutely right, of course. And what all British politicians try to do is not to say we've got a common destiny, but it's to our advantage to be there. And what they managed to achieve was a kind of balancing act by which they could say, look, well, things, but from January the 1st, it really kicks in. And the worry, of course, is the extra paperwork by being outside the EU regulatory area. If you compare the time it takes to get a lorry through from Britain to the continent now, it's about, on average, say, 5 hours. And it's broadly as easy to send goods from London today to Paris or Berlin or Copenhagen as it is to Birmingham or Manchester or Glasgow or Swansea or Belfast. That won't be the case after January 1st. Now, if you look at a country which is outside the customs union and outside the internal market, like Belarus, it takes on average 5 days for lorries to get through. Now, the difference between 5 hours and 5 days is pretty heavy. If you look at Turkey, which is in the EU customs union, but outside the internal market, there are huge delays in lorries. 2 days is considered reasonable. So I'm very worried that companies may not be able to cope with the extra costs. Many of them work on small margins. And with COVID, they're going to be very, very great difficulties.
I think they're already at the ports in Britain and Felixstowe already queuing. I mean, that's partly because of COVID, but I guess the anticipation of business. Vernon, you've often said that Margaret Thatcher misunderstood the internal market. Can you explain that to us? I think it sounds...
Margaret Thatcher was one of the architects of the EU internal market. And perhaps it's one of the paradoxes of Brexit that the two initiatives, two great British initiatives, two great Margaret Thatcher initiatives, which were the internal market and extension of the European Union to the Central and Eastern European ex-communist countries, they're the two factors which led in a way to Brexit, because the admission of the ex-communist countries led to a huge increase in immigration, which was a very salient issue in the referendum. And the internal market led to much greater integration on the part of the EU, which I think was inevitable. And with the internal market, which came about as a result of the Single European Act in 1986, that's the most important of the amendments to the EU constitution. With that came the removal of the veto and the extension of majority voting. Now, Margaret Thatcher was not against that. She was in favour, because she said, perfectly rightly, that if you have over 300 non-tariff barriers to remove and each country has a veto, you'll never do it. So you have to do that by majority vote. But she didn't want it extended further. She wanted it used just for internal market matters, because she saw the internal market as simply a free trade agreement, a kind of extension of World Trade Organization matters, a liberalization, a marketization, if you like, of the European Union. They saw it differently. They saw it as an internal market which required regulation, and in their view, it required certain social and environmental standards to be common amongst the countries, certain standards perhaps in the labor market amongst the countries, just as you have, for example, within Britain and within the United States, broadly speaking, common social, environmental, and labor standards. And that Margaret Thatcher did not fully comprehend. And to the extent that she did, she was opposed to it, because she said this will limit British sovereignty, the ability to make decisions for ourselves. So we've got this conflict, if you like, between national self-determination and sovereignty and multilateralism. And that's a conflict, as it were, within liberalism itself, if you like. And Margaret Thatcher took one side, and then at the time, people like Geoffrey Howe and Michael Heseltine took the other side. There's a conflict within the Conservative Party, which in some ways is still there, it's certainly there in the Labour Party. And it's dogged and bedeviled our membership of the European Union until finally we've decided to leave.
If she had understood it as well as you've explained before, would she have gone ahead and still joined it, do you think? And maybe that is the broader misapprehension that we have in Britain towards the EU. It is a protectionist bloc, to some extent.
That's a very good point. You see, in retirement, she took that point of view. She said it was a historic mistake for us to join. She wrote a book called Statecraft, in which she said we should try and secure fundamental reform in Europe. And if, as I think unlikely, if that didn't work, we should leave. Because you're absolutely right that we never really shared the point of view of the Europeans, because their aim in creating it was not primarily economic, mm-hmm. and certainly not primarily federal. It was a peace initiative, a peace project. And that peace project required the sacrifice of sovereignty by countries which shared in the words of Robert Schuman, French foreign minister in the late 1940s, a common European destiny. Now, you don't mind sharing power with someone with whom you think you have a common destiny. For example, a married couple doesn't mind sharing a bank account because they think they have a common destiny. We don't mind sharing our budget with people in Lancashire or Yorkshire because we have a common destiny. There are some arguments now about Scotland. Do we have a common destiny with them? The SNP would say, no, no, we don't. Now, this is a question about Europe. Do we feel a common destiny? Now, the argument was people in France, Germany, Italy, and Ireland did feel that common destiny. We didn't. We joined for utilitarian economic motives. And therefore, when the economy started going wrong, we said, well, perhaps we don't want to stay in this relationship. It wasn't, as it were, a marriage, or if it was a marriage, it was a marriage of convenience, which we sought to end when it was no longer convenient. I think there was only one prime minister who shared that view about a common destiny, and that was Edward Heath. Yeah. But whether he was really ever in tune with the British people is a very big question.
And you make the point that apart from Boris Johnson, actually every prime minister that we've had since we joined has been in favour. But isn't one of the flaws that they made for 40 years have been in favour, but nobody has actually done a very good job of explaining or articulating that philosophy of a common destiny? We've always had this tension. And maybe it goes back 2,000 years since the Romans came. I don't know. But, you know, there's a sort of accident of geography, isn't there? Which I think is part of that problem, that we do not have a shared destiny.
Well, while you've been talking, I've been thinking, you're talking, of course, about my recent book.
Yes, I know. I was going to mention it.
Which makes this point. And it's absolutely right, of course. And what all British politicians try to do is not to say we've got a common destiny, but it's to our advantage to be there. And what they managed to achieve was a kind of balancing act by which they could say, look, the things we don't like, the integrative measures we don't like, we can keep out of. For example, we've got an opt-out from the euro. We're not part of the Schengen arrangement. We don't wish to accept the social chapter, this, that, and the other. So that was a very delicate balancing act, which in a way collapsed, because it couldn't accommodate immigration. Now, David Cameron tried to get various opt-outs in immigration, but the principle of free movement was too strong for him. Had he been able to do that, I think he might have succeeded in keeping us in. He did manage to negotiate more successfully than many people say, because he protected Britain from the majority in the Eurozone, which is also very important, so they couldn't make decisions about us without our consent. But you couldn't really sell that in the referendum. You couldn't say in the referendum, vote for Europe because the bankers are going to be protected. That wouldn't have been a very powerful cry, I think.
No,
so that balancing act really collapsed. And from having been in Europe but seeking opt-outs, we're now out of Europe but seeking opt-ins, if you like, keeping the balancing act from outside. And that, as you've said, it relates to our long history of semi-detachment, that we're part of Europe, but not wholly in Europe. And it's significant that one of our iconic moments is 1940, when we stood against Europe. And although we were defeated in France, we could carry on fighting because we're an island, which of course France couldn't. France was defeated and therefore out of the war. We were defeated, but carried on. And from that point of view, our position isn't like that of France or Germany, but like, say, Russia, which could also be defeated but continue the war because of her immense landmass. So Russia, too, is in Europe, but not wholly of it, and, of course, not in the European Union. So that is our position, and it's always been very ambiguous. And even with Brexit, it's going to be ambiguous because we are seeking some sort of relationship.
Do you think it is possible, I know you are an eminent historian and political scientist, but to where you started, to look forward, do you think that we can, you put it very well, we are now outside and seeking opt-in. Do you think actually that is probably a better position for us to be in because of that semi-detachment? I mean, the deal, yes, of course, we're going to have lots of months probably still, but once we get over that, can we return to a really good, harmonious relationship?
Before I answer that, I'm told your network bandwidth is low. I don't know what that means.
Oh, it comes up on you.
Right. But let me answer your point. No, I don't think it is, let me say, because if you belong to a tennis club and you want to have influence in that tennis club, it's best to remain a member. If you leave the club because you say the subscription is too high and you don't like the rules much, and you're then outside, fair enough. The tennis club may say, goodbye, good luck, perhaps you'll join another tennis club. We've enjoyed being with you, all the best. But if you then say, but wait a moment, we still want to play on the tennis courts, you know, we want to leave the club but want to play on the tennis courts, you're not in a strong position because you're seeking various benefits which are available in their full version only to members of the club. And the tennis club will make put place various obligations upon you. You won't be in as strong a position as those who are in the club. You can't expect to be. So I think the only rationale of leaving is by saying we want to join a totally different tennis club. Now, what does that mean in practical terms? It means striking out on a different economic path. Now, what is that different economic path going to be? We haven't really had that debate. But you may say one sensible, in fact, I think the only sensible economic path would be to strike out as a global free trade country, kind of Hong Kong or Singapore, or perhaps a better analogy is New Zealand, because when we joined the European Union in 1973, New Zealand had to find new markets. So they developed a free trade economy, they cut subsidies, they cut tariffs, they cut regulations. It was very disruptive. A number of farmers committed suicide when their subsidies went. Now, should we follow that path? It's broadly speaking a Thatcherite path. You lower corporate and personal taxation to encourage investors to come here and invest. You get rid of tariffs, regulations, subsidies and the like. It's very disruptive. It means a lot of industries would go to the wall, but hopefully new industries would develop in the market economy. Now, I think that was very alien to the temper of the British people who voted for Brexit. If you like, the foot soldiers of the Northeast, they didn't want more competition. They wanted more protection against global forces. And whether it was possible or not before COVID, it's almost certainly not possible with COVID, because COVID has required much greater state intervention, much greater public expenditure. That has to be paid for either by tax rises or by cuts in the welfare state. And the last thing people will want is the disruption which that particular economic path would entail. So I'm not clear what now the logic of Brexit actually is. And I think it's up to the Brexiteers to put forward a very clear economic model of how we are to proceed now we're outside the European Union. The Brexit argument, as far as I can see, is yesterday's argument. It's gone. Whether you're in favour or not is now not relevant. We are out of the European Union and unlikely to join them in the near future. The debate should now be what economic model is best for us outside the EU.
You raise a very interesting point, and quite apart from what the public might want, we certainly don't have a Conservative government, certainly not a leadership that is minded to take those sort of radical, bold measures. In fact, Boris has even described himself as a Brexiteer, hasn't he? He is by nature one nation, interventionist, big projects. And the last thing, nobody's talking about tax cuts or free enterprise zones or any of those things that will unleash Keynes's animal spirits. So you're describing a really quite, not dangerous, but an ambivalent situation which could leave us not going anywhere. I mean, human nature isn't like that, but what would you, if we do need that market economy, which I agree with you, by the way, how can that be achieved under this leadership?
That's a very good question, and I wish I knew the answer. The great danger of what's happening now is we get back to statist and restrictionist attitudes which try and hold back processes of economic and industrial change. We did that in the 1960s and 1970s when governments tried to spot winners. And this is what Sir Vince Cable, the former leader of the Liberal Democrats, wants now, an industrial strategy. Terrible word, I think, because someone once said governments aren't good at picking winners, but losers are very good at picking governments. And most of that money in the 60s and 70s was down the drain. What we need to spend money on, And it's fair to say this government has begun in that process. We need to spend much more on skills. Further education in particular, which is the Cinderella of the education system, wasn't protected from cuts in the way that schools were. And above all, adult retraining, huge amounts of money needed on that for the inevitable disruption that Brexit will cause. And also generous welfare payments for those who are incommoded by these disruptions. They need to be tided over while they're learning new skills. Above all, government must tell people, and this I think applies particularly to the white working class, that you cannot leave school at 16 or 18 without qualifications and hope to get a job for life. And there's still a strong anti-educational culture, in my view, amongst many people in the English working class. And we hear a lot about ethnic relations, and there are awful blemishes there. But nevertheless, I think on the whole, it's a success story. And ethnic minorities are now more successful in getting into university than white teenagers, and also more successful in getting professional jobs. We've integrated ethnic minorities quite well. Yeah. We haven't yet integrated the white working class very effectively into our modern system. So that is all absolutely crucial. And finally, we've no room now for vanity projects, and we should get rid of HS2 tomorrow and use the money for skills training and welfare payments.
Yeah, totally agree. Why do you think that that is the position of the white working class today? Is it the result of 20, 30 years of welfareism?
It's much older than that. There's always been an anti-educational culture in this country. Not so much in Scotland, though one of the achievements of the SNP government is to lower educational standards in Scotland to an even worse level than in England. But it's always been a feature, and it goes very deep into our history. And of course, until the 20th century, education was only for a very small minority. Most people left school at 12 or 14, and they got no skills training at all. There was nothing like the Technische Hochschule in Germany. People were being trained for manual jobs or low-skilled jobs, and there was never really much concentration on improving the skills training. It was made more difficult after the war with full employment. I'm not in any way against full employment, of course not. It was a very good thing indeed, but it did mean there wasn't much incentive for skills training, because you could, as I suggested before, leave school at 16, the earliest possible age, or 15 and until the 1970s, I think, 15, and you didn't need any skills, you'd be employed for life. And that, of course, was a disincentive, low-cost labour to innovate and move to a more modern economy. So I think it has roots very deep in British life, much deeper and longer than the welfare state. And it needs radical change. And we've been able to survive, actually, because of successive waves of immigrants, some Huguenots, Germans, Jews, immigrants from the Caribbean, Africa, and South Asia and East Africa. And they really kept the British economy afloat. But we do need to do much more for our indigenous population. And this is best done by government. The main role of government is not to legislate or to put money into businesses, but to teach and explain to people the situation and how it can be improved.
Totally agree, and actually you're right. It really is a symptom of our early industrial revolution, actually, yes. Isn't it? I mean, that's the real root of it. And we've never got over it. It's been by accident. I mean, we talked about Norway earlier on, but I remember my father always used to say, you know, in Norway to an engineer or a plumber, you would discuss Ibsen, or I mean, it wasn't just high culture, but you know, the general level. And in fact, it's even worse than what you say here, because the level of literacy is at the age of 16 is horrendous.
It's one of the lowest in the OECD, yeah, literacy and numeracy. That is absolutely right. And there was all the suspicion in industry of clever people. I remember once when I was a young don in Oxford, at dinner one evening, one of the guests was a director of British Leyland, and he said, "We've got one graduate on our board. We call him the Clever Dick." And he said, "Most of your people are quite useless. They ought to be doing research." There was a great hostility to education, and we were one of the last countries, advanced countries, to adopt proper management education, because the argument was you learn on the job, you didn't need the skills, and that's held us back.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, Boris should probably borrow Tony Blair's mantra of education, education, but not for university.
That's right.
For second.
Our universities are the best in the world, apart from the American universities. And until recently, they were there to educate the elite only. And now they're, of course, mass institutions. Arguably, many people who go to universities and take non-vocational degrees would do better in colleges of further education or the sort of thing the old polytechnics did, technical colleges. I've always had much sympathy, though it's a bit derided now, with Kenneth Baker's idea of people leaving school at 14 and going to technical schools to learn skills, because there are many people at 14 who are not interested, shall we say, in history or biology, but would be very interested in engineering, learning how to make cars and so on, and would be trained. And then they might come back to academic interests later. Was forcing them to stay at school is not much use for them, and maybe harmful to the other students whose bent is academic. So I think we ought to have more of those technical colleges than Kenneth Baker.
No, totally agree. And of course, it's a paradox, because we make them stay on, but actually they're not learning anything. So is the point of making them stay on? Yeah. Bernard, does it worry you the level of debate within our political system at the moment about these very big issues? You don't really hear anybody within the Labour Party or whatever's left of the Lib Dems. These should be the issues that they should be fighting over within the Chamber of the House of Commons. But, you know, when do you ever hear any?
There's too much concentration on the immediate. But part of the reason is that both parties are internally divided, and there's a kind of cultural division within them, perhaps most obviously in the Labour Party, between, as it were, the Islington types like Starmer and Jeremy Corbyn, who on the whole were Remainers, and many of their supporters from, shall we say, the North East, the North West and so on, who were Leavers, the working class element, if you like, the division between Hampstead and Hartlepool. Now you've got a not dissimilar division actually in the Conservative Party, though most of the Remainers have now been purged from the party, so it's veiled there. But I think that's one of the reasons that any debate would expose divisions within the parties. So it's true, the level of debate isn't high, and Brexit has been traumatic. It's now gone on 4.5 years, on and on and on. It's not a single event. It's a long, drawn-out and agonising process. And it won't end. Even if we do get a deal, it will continue, because there'll be all sorts of discussions about the proper future relationship.
Do you think it's a tragic decision that we've decided to leave?
Well, I think it was a mistake, but I think it was probably going to happen. I just think we didn't fit in very well into Europe. And those who were most pro-European in Britain, like, for example, Edward Heath, always saw it as a radical option, that it would need an alteration in the minds of the British people. And people who supported staying in Europe shared that view. I mean, I was one of them. I hoped we could alter attitudes. We failed. And the British people are deeply conservative with a small c. That may not be a bad thing, maybe a good thing. Very difficult to convince them of change. Changing their deep-seated attitude. Even Margaret Thatcher didn't do it in many respects.
Yeah.
So I think we were probably going to leave anyway. But the problem now, as I said a bit earlier, is to find the best path we can to make a success of it. And that requires, as I think we both agree, a debate about the future economic role of the country. That's the debate we ought to be having.
Yeah. What do you say to some of the Remainers, some of the main campaigners, such as Peter Mandelson's view last week, that actually that by pushing, by the people's vote and pushing for a second referendum, actually you sort of forced a hard Brexit, and what they should have been working on was trying to have a I guess by soft Brexit, EEA membership or indeed EFTA membership. Do you think they were viable options?
I suppose the difficulty with any of these soft options is that they mean observing the rules of the European Union without being represented there, regulation without representation. Now, Norway is often called a faxed democracy because the decisions of the European Council are faxed to Norway for comments, but they don't often take much notice of Norway because it's not represented there, doesn't have a vote. And that's the problem with Peter Mandelson's ideas. Yeah. You see, we could be
if you say we keep to the rules of the European Union, you may then say, well, what's the point of leaving?
Yeah.
For example, if we had the Norwegian option in the European Economic Area, we have to have free movement. Now, people say, well, one of the motives for leaving the EU is we want to control our own immigration from the EU. You can't do that in Norway. You have to observe a lot of the EU rules. Similarly, in Switzerland, you may say Switzerland has sovereignty because Switzerland decides. But if Switzerland decides not to keep to EU rules, there are consequences in terms of sanctions. For example, recently Switzerland had a referendum restricting immigration from the EU. Now that went with sanctions from the EU, so they've altered it. And that's the difficulty of the Peter Mandelson approach. You know, if you have a soft Brexit, in a way there's no such thing. You're part of the EU with a soft Brexit, but you're just not represented there. So it's easy to see the logic of people saying, well, look, we're leaving not because we want to have the same rules, but because we want to have different rules.
Mm-hmm. No, and indeed, probably one of the main arguments, certainly why I voted Remain, was that I felt this was totally political and geographic, and that we have to be at the top table with France and Germany. That is the only way, in a sense, that you will be able to dictate policy, and we should have taken a stronger position. We should have been, you know, louder, not just on opt-outs, but in trying to persuade them to reform in the areas that we thought. But maybe that was an impossible dream too.
Absolutely, because I said earlier that one main motive was to secure peace in Europe. Yeah. But the second motive was that Europe should have a stronger voice in the world.
Yeah.
That it shouldn't be dominated by the superpowers, particularly by America. Now, Europe without Britain is not going to have a stronger voice in the world, and Britain will not have a stronger voice in the world on its own as opposed to being a powerful member of the European Union. And even outside Europe, Britain needs to cooperate with Europe in terms of defence. One of the weaknesses of the European Union, it's the only one of the four powers in the world, the others being America, Russia and China, which can't defend itself, which still relies on America 75 years after the end of the war. Now, if it's going to remedy that, if Europe is to be a power in the world, only Britain and France can give that sort of lead. Germany can't, for obvious historical reasons, and she doesn't spend up to her NATO requirement of 2% of GDP a year. We and the French do. So even outside Europe, we need to cooperate with the French. It's fair to say the French don't understand that. And President Macron, for whom I have great admiration as a great force for liberalism in Europe, he sees Brexit merely in terms of financial and economic opportunities for France. Mm. He doesn't see it in geopolitical terms. And that's damaging, not just for Britain, but for France, because France has taken the lead, particularly since the time of General de Gaulle, in wanting a stronger Europe in the world, which isn't utterly dependent on America. And if you're going to do that, you can only do it with Britain. And it's also fair to say, that's not a point often made, but Britain, despite appearances sometimes, is a very powerful force in the world for political liberalism, because we're the only major country in Europe which doesn't have a racist or populist party in our legislature. If you look at Germany, the Alternative for Deutschland, which is a neo-Nazi party in some respects, is the official opposition. In France, the Front National was a leading party in the European elections last year. In many other countries, for example, in Sweden, the populist party has stopped any other party getting a majority. We don't have a party like that. And even UKIP, the Brexit party, I don't support it, but it's not a nasty party in those terms. So we're a very strong liberal force in the world, and Europe desperately needs that. In modern times, President Macron has said that Europe faces a challenge from the illiberal nations like Hungary and Poland. Now, we are part of a liberal bloc, and therefore, even outside Europe, we should try and pull our weight in that direction.
No, that's a very, very good point. And it sort of speaks into the point about actually France and Britain on a military basis have very close relationships, I mean, since David Cameron's days. And, you know, France and Britain really are the military powers within NATO in Europe, aren't they? So I don't quite understand why Macron is so short-sighted about, if you like, annoying Britain. He needs us very much for the, if you like, the internal safety of Europe.
So that's absolutely right. A former French ambassador once said to me how sad it was that Britain and France only got together in times of disaster.
Yeah.
Munich and Suez, he gave as instances. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the history of the 20th century, had we had a firmer alliance with France and a strong army, both in 1914 and 1939, we might have avoided war. So I think that is very important. And I think the French are mistaken in believing that Germany can offer the sort of leadership in Europe that they seek. For historic reasons, Germany can't. A senior figure in the British Foreign Office told me that he said to his German counterpart, you know, after Brexit, you'll be more powerful than ever. And the German replied, yes, but even less willing and less able to use that power. That, of course, is profoundly true. Mm-hmm. And Germany cannot do more than lead in terms of soft power because of its long and difficult military history. So France can't get what it seeks from Germany, but it can from Britain.
Mm. Fabulous. Well, thank you so much, Vernon.
Thank you.